Good afternoon, Mr. O'Neill.
Senator Cleveland and Representative Hobbins, members of the committee, Chris O'Neill from Saco. I'm the Director of Government Affairs at Friends of Maids Mountains. We're a three-year-old nonprofit that's dedicated to clean energy that is sustainable for Maine's environment and economy. As a 501c3, FMM expends the majority of its effort educating and sometimes shocking the public about the high impacts and low benefits that come from grid-scale wind power. You'll hear, and you have heard, those of you who have heard from me, FMM assert that Maine made an egregious error when it enacted the wind law in 2008, therein rolling out the red carpet to an unprecedented industrialization of Maine's remote wilderness areas. The wind law also exposed taxpayers and electricity ratepayers to unprecedented financial risk, so FMM's business is to balance the needs of the economy and the environment. Because, as you know, energy policy is largely the domain of public relations firms and law firms, I am leaving with you a packet that, in plain English, dispels some of the myths that a lot of people believe, and it lays out some facts in this otherwise esoteric policy area. To elevate the discussion above beliefs and hype and good intentions that have generally propelled wind power to its current position of prominence and general favor, FMM will be asking you to consider facts when you need to and to engage in critical thinking when making policy predicated upon your fair consideration of such things as impact versus benefit. When you read the materials in your packet, and I truly ask that you do, I try to keep it short, you will come to understand why we say that grid-scale wind power is certainly unnecessary and not all that useful to the grid. You will see also in the packet how Maine ranks as one of the cleanest states in the nation for both emissions from electricity generation and for all man-made emissions, particularly for CO2. You will see in there that Maine has the highest renewable portfolio mandate in the nation. You will learn that if Maine builds out the statutory goals for wind power, we will have erected the equivalent of a line of 40-plus story tall, gyrating, blinking, noisy structures spaced every quarter mile for essentially the length of Interstate 95 from Kittery to Holton, only not in the highway, but across generally the mountaintops. You'll learn in there that from our packet that achieving the build-out will not close coal plants and will only imperceptibly move the needle on carbon dioxide emissions, despite our desire to see that happen in a better way. You'll see in there that windmills will do nothing to get us off of oil because we've already done that. You'll see that 2,700 megawatts of wind capacity, as articulated in the statute, can only produce part-time the amount of electricity that essentially one moderately sized conventional generator can do full-time. And you'll learn that almost $1 billion has been spent on Maine wind projects at a time when private sector economic development specialists are quite happy to see $100,000 to $120,000 per job invested to create a job. Those numbers, depending upon whether you count 500 or 1,000 jobs in Maine wind, are up in the millions of dollars per job. And a large chunk of that money goes overseas for foreign manufactured goods. You might also learn in there that those 300 miles of windmill-laden ridges can really only effectively add about 2 or 3% more electricity to the New England grid, a grid that really doesn't need the generation. We'll have plenty of specific recommendations. We've got one bill that we're sponsoring as the session progresses, but in a nutshell, I'll say this. There is no other industry since the dawn of regulation in Maine that has commandeered the law the way this industry has since 2008. Not even the cornerstones of Maine industry like fishing and farming and forestry and textiles post-regulation have enjoyed the favor that wind has. We'll be asking you to change the law to level it back out, given the measured benefits versus impacts. And lastly, I'll implore you, when you get the chance, if you have not already, to read the 2012 wind energy assessment that was provided by the Energy Office back in the spring to your predecessors. That is a critical tool that will help guide you in your deliberation. It's an annual requirement that the director provide you that report, but in the last legislature, there was quite an outpouring of concern from citizens about various aspects of the wind buildout, and most of those kind of got lumped into a directive for the Office of Energy to address, in addition to what he's normally required to address, several particulars. And if you want to skip right to page 43 of that report when you do, please familiarize yourself with that, because we will be talking about those issues as the session moves on. I do appreciate the work that you're about to embark upon, and I will be here for quite a bit of it, I believe. And as always, I stand ready to either answer questions or supply more information as needed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. O'Neill. Any questions at all?
Real quick one, sir.
Yes, Representative Dunphy.
Congress just reauthorized the PTC, the production tax credits. Can you do you have any thoughts on what the potential impact is on the state of Maine?
Yes, the production tax credit had expired at the end of 2012, and it got kind of carried into the fiscal cliff legislation. It, because it provides a sizable level of subsidy, particularly after tax value, to the developer of the wind project, it really does exacerbate or enhance their ability to get projects done and financed on the private side. So we've seen several projects that have been in the queue that we thought were kind of on ice until the PTC got reauthorized. And we expect that if I were in the wind business, I'd be rushing to get it under construction, however that ends up being defined, by the end of the year. For our part, we'll be fighting tooth and nail to prevent them from reaching the deadline by the end of the year. That means courts, appeals, BEP, however long it takes. That's just the reality of our political situation.
Where does the Friends of the Maine Mountain stand on Canadian Hydro, and do you think it would satisfy what we're trying to do with wind?
On parle français, si. Our position on that is that there's an awful lot of very loud volume on both ends of the discussion about that. And it's, again, it's an esoteric issue. We think that the people who fear that it will, the 800-pound gorilla will come in and put a stranglehold on Maine, we think that's histrionic. Likewise, we think that those who assert that better connection to a resource like Nalcor or Hydro-Quebec, who might compete against each other, by the way, we think that the people who view that as some sort of panacea are kind of all wet too, pardon the pun. But the point's worth mentioning, that if indeed we want to close eventually within our grid a particularly dirty coal plant or some of the peak load plants like what we have in Portland, Casco Bay, we're not going to do that with windmills. And some combination of gas and wind might help to provide the type of electricity that those plants provide. Why not do it with one that is versatile like hydro? And particularly where we're a summer peaking grid, it's a pretty good marriage. Again, it's, anything can be negotiated. You can sign contracts for anything, so we're not fearful of it.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Any other questions? Senator.
Where does the Friends of Maine Mountain stand on offshore wind?
Well, they tell me there are mountains out there in the middle of the ocean, but we don't really have them within our purview. Because we do have what we consider to be a dual mission, which is environmental and economic, you won't hear me a whole lot talk about the viewshed around here, NIMBY, et cetera. We were born, our genesis was with a few people in Western Maine who didn't like the idea of Kibbe, and there was a project being proposed right near Sugarloaf, Reddington and Black Nubble, and it was a NIMBY genesis. That's plain and simple, that's what it was. But they've since come to embrace the technical aspects of the policy area and have come to say, almost like a public advocate would, let's take a full accounting of the full impacts and benefits. So, with that preamble, I will tell you that we've submitted commentary on the pending Statoil deliberation, which is going to happen day after tomorrow, that simply says if and when offshore wind can provide what would be considered necessary and useful generation at an economic cost, then it might have a place in the marketplace. But right now, it's in the laboratory, where it should be. We fully support $20 million going to Habib Daggett and the university system. That's what universities should do, is research. But it should not jump from the laboratory to the marketplace, especially by government action that mandates exorbitant costs, even if it's just a test case, because we will have gotten the camel's nose under the tent, and there will be no turning back. So we're cautious.
Thank you, Mr. O'Neill.
Thank you.